For most of American history, women in the workplace understood that at some point in their careers, they would almost certainly encounter badly behaved male colleagues or bosses. Finding a way to just deal with it was an unwritten condition of employment. Then came the revelations about Harvey Weinstein's numerous assaults on women, followed by the Me Too movement, and the recognition that nobody should have to put up with such abuse at work. But not every bad colleague is Harvey Weinstein. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Allegations of inappropriate behavior are often all about nuance, and the Me Too hashtag is a blunt instrument. It fails to probe context or consider whether the proper punishment, where rather the proper punishment falls, on the continuum between a sharp stop that and a kind of lifetime ban from someone's profession. My guest says it is really important to believe women, but she also believes these stories may be more complicated than our instantaneous social media verdicts suggest. Pamela Paul is an opinion columnist with the New York Times. Her recent op-ed was titled, "Netflix Fired Frank Langella. Was that the right thing to do?" Pamela, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get to the specifics of these allegations, we should note that in some ways this conversation isn't really about what Frank Langella did per se. What makes his story a good way into talking about some of these things you've been thinking about?
Well, actually, that very fact is a good way in because we almost never know exactly what happened, right? It often comes down to a he said, she said situation when these things become public. And in most workplaces, these kinds of allegations don't become public. When someone is accused of or wants to accuse someone else of inappropriate behavior, whether it's sexual or some other kind of misconduct, there's usually a process in any workplace or, you know, organization where you go to HR, you go to management, confidentiality is protected. But in a situation with a public figure, like an actor, someone in the media, it often becomes quite public. And so you're left knowing that something happened, but not really knowing exactly what. And so that makes it very different from most of the kind of workplace problems like this that arise.
What do we know about how Langella lost his part on this? I guess it was a Netflix series based on Edgar Allan Poe stories.
Yes, so it was a loosely based series called The Fall of the House of Usher, which is an Edgar Allan Poe short story, very loosely based, because what we do know is that Frank Langella was playing the title role. And in the series, he has a wife. There is no wife in Edgar Allan Poe's story, as some who read it will remember. But he was accused initially, and he's the one who got into the most detail at first, of putting his hand on the actress playing his younger wife's leg. And he said that in this, he was fully clothed. Both of them were fully clothed. And then he was also accused of making inappropriate jokes and comments, calling someone babe or honey. And what we also know about that touch is that it was not a sort of approved touch. So the way in which sex scenes tend to work nowadays in Hollywood, and a lot of this is post Me Too, is there is now a new job in Hollywood on set called an intimacy coordinator. And that person works with the rest of the team to really block out, this is what we are going to permit. What Langella said in his a column that he wrote for Deadline is that, you know, this is really different from the way it used to work, where you could improvise, you could get in the moment and perhaps move a hand somewhere that wasn't formally blocked out. And that's what he did. I mean, we should say Frank Langella is 84 years old. He's been doing this a long time. He has over 100 screen credits between TV and theater, between TV and film, and in addition to doing a lot of Broadway and other theater. And so he's been doing this a long time, but this is a very new way of doing these kinds of things. And my guess is, and I haven't looked at every film in his recent history, but given that he is 84, it's probably been a while since he's done a love scene like this, and perhaps the first time he's done it post Me Too.
So I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but just so everyone understands, this unwanted touch on the leg that happened when both actors were fully clothed, this was in the context of filming this scene, right? This wasn't like in a trailer somewhere when they were having a moment alone.
Correct. So this was for filming a love scene, is how it was framed. Not a sex scene, but a love scene, some intimate scene that the TV series has not come out. Obviously, so we don't know the full context of where it appeared in the story, but it was described as a love scene. Now, that said, subsequent to the initial firing and to Frank Langella sort of coming out in his own defense in a column in Deadline, there was then another reported story in Deadline that had a lot of comments off the record, so no one was willing to be named in the production, saying, "Oh, this was sort of part of a pattern of inappropriate behavior." None of it was particularly sexual in nature, but it had to do with sort of inappropriate jokes and comments. And someone said that he was also accused of racially insensitive comments. So that was kind of added in later on.
So what was Netflix's response to those complaints?
So Netflix's response, again, as far as we know, they are not publicly commenting on this, although they have sort of confirmed the very basic details, was to fire him, and they replaced him with another actor, Bruce Greenwood.
So Langella argues that he did not intend to harass or upset anyone. Netflix executives reportedly said they're not interested in impact. He had made a colleague or colleagues uncomfortable. What is the relationship between the kind of sexual harassment and assault reported in some Me Too cases and discomfort? Are they at different ends of the same spectrum?
Well, so first thing, what they said was, at least according to Langella, is that they were not interested in intention, or in intent. They were only interested in impact. So, in other words, it didn't matter if he didn't intend to violate her privacy or didn't intend to offend anyone by calling them baby, but that is irrelevant, that what matters is that that person felt an impact, felt a negative impact, was so upset or distraught or disturbed or uncomfortable by the situation that they felt like it was not okay to work with him any longer on the project. So there is then, to answer your other question, there is a wide range, as with any workplace situation, and a lot of it is, of course, very subjective. And when there are two parties involved, what is offensive to one person isn't necessarily offensive to another. So someone might tell a joke and think it's really funny, and the person on the other end doesn't receive it that way. And especially when issues around identity, gender, sexual preference, race are involved, of course, people are particularly sensitive. And then on the other end of the spectrum, from an unintended joke that causes offense, or a comment or an endearment that isn't willingly accepted in a workplace. And then on the other end, you have someone like Harvey Weinstein, who was, of course, convicted of rape and serious sexual misconduct.
So, with a situation like Weinstein, I think a lot of people heard about that story and heard about the fact that he was able to go around completely unfettered for many, many years and really shattered a lot of people. And it feels like the entire society said, "Oh my goodness, we need to not let this happen again." Have we taken the wrong approach to ensuring that figures like Weinstein are not allowed to continue to do bad things?
Well, it is true that I think, again, particularly in Hollywood and in the media, where some very big, powerful figures, not just Harvey Weinstein, but Matt Lauer, Charlie Rose, Bill O'Reilly, Roger Ailes, got away with behavior over a very long period of time. And organizations are like fundamentally conservative in terms of protecting their reputations and their bottom line. And so they've sort of said, okay, we want to do everything we can to prevent this from happening again. So they really have gone sort of a full 180. One of the interesting contrasts between Frank Langella specifically and someone like Harvey Weinstein or Roger Ailes or Bill O'Reilly is that in those cases, at least within, you know, parts of the media, if not the wider public, it was well known, long rumored, that these situations these behaviors were taking place, and it was just a matter of, for various reasons, not being able to fully report on it until it had been going on for quite a long period of time. In the case of Frank Langella, and again, perhaps things will come out, but this is someone who has been working for decades, and at least to date, there weren't sort of longtime whispers, and there certainly weren't any allegations that went at all public over the course of that period. So this felt like this was very sudden, at least in his case, as far as we know.
Many people understand the cumulative effect of microaggressions in a way they didn't years ago. And I think that includes victims of microaggressions, right? It seems reasonable that lots of experience with these can make one especially sensitive to any particular incident in a way that a perpetrator might not understand, that others outside might not understand. What do we do with the fact that, you know, one person might be made to account for that cumulative effect because they're kind of the straw that broke the camel's back?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very tough moral conundrum. It's really complicated. These things are subjective, and the extent to which you sort of punish someone or you know, offer consequences to someone because of that last straw, particularly if they were not aware of people being made uncomfortable up to that point, it's really tricky. It's also, you know, when you talk about something like microaggressions, again, it's very much in the eye of the beholder. And this is one reason why I do think we do need to pay attention to intent. And we do need to, when it comes to protecting people in the workplace generally, think about protecting both parties. Both parties are employees of the organization. And so you want to, as much as you want to be sensitive to and attend to those who are making accusations or who feel uncomfortable in the workplace, also then consider the person who is being accused.
Of course, when companies try to educate everyone, sometimes these trainings turn into kind of legalistic things, right? Where it's like, you're allowed to do this, but not to do that. Here's what's going to happen. They don't necessarily relate to the kinds of really complicated questions that arise.
Oh, for sure. I mean, look, the law can be very black and white, and organizations, again, are fundamentally very conservative with this kind of thing. They are trying to protect themselves. No one wants to be responsible for harboring or for allowing the behavior of someone like Harvey Weinstein ever again. And that is all to the good. But human beings, we're a little bit more complicated than that. And so you have to kind of figure out, well, how do you allow for a certain amount of nuance in there? And I do think, again, that's why it is important to think about intent.
I have to say, Pamela, these are hard conversations to have, even in a setting like this one, where neither one of us has any direct relationship to the events in question. We are women. I never want to come off as an apologist for abuse of power or privilege, but I have lived on the planet long enough to know, like, humans who spend enough time together in work or in any other setting will at some point make one another uncomfortable. That's not always the same thing as unsafe.
Yes. I mean, and I think it's important that there's a fine line between being offended by something, being made uncomfortable by something, and being really intolerant of other people, right? And again, that's why I think intent is important, because if someone does something that upsets you or offends you, and rather than go to them and say, hey, this thing bothered me, and was that your intent? And allowing the person maybe the chance to say, like, absolutely not, I didn't realize that was offensive. In the case of someone who's 84, you know, and again, just of a previous generation, our sort of standards and mores have shifted over time, and often in a good way. But again, not everyone sort of has gotten the memo fully. And so it's like, we're not allowing for that just bit of generosity you know, again, I'm not trying to say that it's the behavior is okay or to excuse it, but to allow for, opportunities for people to maybe reconcile these things among themselves.
Other folks might say, look, we've tried giving the benefit of the doubt to people who make others uncomfortable or put them in bad positions for a really long time, and that led people like Harvey Weinstein and Matt Lauer and the other, cavalcade of terrible people that you mentioned earlier to get away with this behavior.
That's true. But at the same time, each individual person in each individual circumstance should not necessarily be held responsible for an entire history of people who have come before them. And I think one of the troubling aspects of the kind of fallout from Me Too is that we do tend to think in very black and white terms. So, for example, someone might say, believe women or believe all women. And that in and itself, honestly, as a woman, I will say I find to be kind of a sexist idea, because I think women are just as good liars as men are. And they're just as complicated, and they're not to be put on a pedestal. And I.
Pamela, you dropped out for a second there. I just want to make sure you're still on the line with us.
I am still here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's go to the phones. We have Chris on the line in Dallas, Texas. Hi, Chris. Chris, hi. Are you with us?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go right ahead, please.
I'm sorry. For whatever reason, there's a whole lot of feedback in the background.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on. If you can hear me well, I'll just turn down and keep talking.
Perfect.
My name's Chris. I live in Dallas. And the reason I'm calling is because your guest did say that she believes that both parties need to be given the space to tell their story, I guess. And I was in a situation, I worked for a major corporate company in the United States, I promise you know the name, and I went to HR about harassment I was experiencing at work, and they took that approach, which in my experience, HR usually does give both sides the space to tell their story. And what happened was my abuser was protected because he was higher up than me. He was my manager. And that culminated in him sexually assaulting me at work. And I never received justice for that. So what does that look like to you when you're saying give both sides, both the accuser and the accusee, space? What does that look like in a fair way? And I'm going to go ahead and hang up my phone because of this feedback. Thank you.
Thanks for sharing your story, Chris. I'm sorry that happened to you. What about that, Pamela?
Well, I think that sounds like a terrible situation. I think that obviously it sounds like the organization, the corporation, didn't take those accounts seriously and didn't, that they didn't handle it in the best way. But I don't think that it necessarily, again, means that both sides shouldn't be allowed to have a voice. I mean, when you think about our justice system, you are supposed to be innocent until proven guilty, not the other way around. And so you do need to allow someone the opportunity to offer their own side, to be able to defend themselves. How an organization then takes those two accounts and reconciles them and then moves forward is, of course, a whole other question. And in this case, and again, I'm very sorry for the person who called in, Chris, but obviously they mishandled that terribly.
So Langella said he was advised not to fight these allegations, but rather to publicly and abjectly apologize for committing an offense. This sounds easy enough. It can feel like an admission of guilt. Sometimes people really haven't done anything wrong. And sometimes people feel like they shouldn't be, they won't accept that they've done anything wrong. There's also no easy way to decide which, is there?
Right. I mean, look, if we don't know, and I should say this once again, we don't know exactly what happened. I wasn't there on the set. And that's not to say that we can't talk about it. But I do think if we do talk about it, it is important to acknowledge the fact that we can't speak about these circumstances with any kind of certainty if we were not there. And especially given the fact that neither Langella nor Netflix would answer questions on the record about exactly what did take place. So we only know these loose facts around it. And again, this case is different, and these cases in the media and in Hollywood are different in that part of it can become public in a way that, ordinarily doesn't happen in a workplace because these actions get reported on. But not knowing the full story allows us to cut sort of jump to these kinds of very quick and often black and white conclusions. And to get to the question of public apology, it really does feel like at this point, there is the kind of the playbook that people are told to follow. It does feel very legalistic, a way to protect everyone, a way to hopefully allow for quote unquote comeback. And, you know, again, you have to think about, well, some parties, let's suppose someone is innocent, they should be allowed to be able to prove themselves innocent in a public way and to continue their, you know, to continue to pursue their career. But we don't really allow for that opportunity. Now, of course, someone might be guilty. And as we know from recent reporting on Harvey Weinstein, whose conviction was just, you know, confirmed in New York, that we know that he continued to believe that he was going to somehow have a comeback.
How do we decide whether to sort of believe and accept public apologies? I'm not talking about individuals who've been directly affected. I think we can all agree that's a separate space and people need to sort of figure out what to do for themselves. But so often now we hear about these things and then we hear a public apology. It seems to me that sometimes people either mistrust or trust the apology based on the opinion they had going in.
Yes, I think that we are at a point, given the proliferation of apologies, very public apologies by everyone from cookbook authors to podcast hosts to actors, you know, there is a kind of line that is taken. And we did see, for example, we have seen that when someone apologizes and doesn't necessarily hit all the points that they are meant to hit, people will then get very upset and will say that the apology wasn't good enough. And sometimes the person will be fired or whatever it might be. The repercussions will continue despite that apology. So I do worry that, you know, it's hard to tell when an apology is sincere and when it's enough and when it's not just simply orchestrated by, you know, a PR agency.
When it comes to putting these situations into context, what rules or what standards should we apply in deciding just how bad something was based on the allegations that are made? I mean, so many of these are not, Harvey Weinstein is a different story, but so many of these do not involve things that are criminally punishable.
That's right. And, you know, again, in a workplace, it doesn't necessarily have to be criminally punishable. But if someone is accused of something and there isn't a good process in place, not everyone, you know, earn millions and millions of dollars like Harvey Weinstein. There are people who have been accused of something, again, a much less extreme degree of infraction. And
my guest is Pamela Paul. Pamela, please continue. Sorry, you dropped out again there for a moment.
Oh, I'm sorry. You know, I think that if someone has done something and it's not a criminal offense, but it's just something, again, a more minor infraction, they could lose their job and they could become kind of an untouchable, someone who is really hard then to rehire. And that can affect their livelihood. Not everyone is a multimillionaire the way Harvey Weinstein is. Not everyone can weather that kind of, you know, financial impact. Never mind the really terrible emotional impact. If you are, say, falsely accused, or if you did something that, you know, you didn't intend to offend, or if it was just minor and you genuinely feel terrible about it.
I think back an incident in my own life years ago when I was heavily pregnant with one of my children. I had a colleague, actually a woman, who constantly talked about like how big I was getting. And these comments in hindsight made me pretty uncomfortable. If we'd been living in the climate we're living in now, someone might have expected me to raise a fuss about this. As it turns out, this colleague, those were insensitive, really stupid remarks, but they weren't things that made this person unable to be a good coworker and a good manager and other things. And I worry sometimes that we're going to lose a lot of people based on this standard of discomfort alone.
Yes. And again, it is really subjective, right? Because it made you uncomfortable. And it for someone else, it may have made them so uncomfortable. And we, you know, perhaps because of things that occurred to them in their past, perhaps because they had already had an incident like that, that they would have felt that the workplace was intolerable and that they had to quit. Now, the tough thing is, it's all really subjective, you know. And when Me Too happened, there were a number of women who said, look, I've had this kind of thing happen, and it was no big deal for me. And then people pounced on them and said, well, how dare you judge the fact that it wasn't a big deal for you, because for someone else, those same exact actions would have been a really big deal. You know, again, we're all human. We're all different. I, you know, like most women, have had situations where people touched me inappropriately, flirted with me inappropriately, did things that, again, are fireable offenses nowadays. For me personally, at the time, it didn't have that effect. But again, it doesn't, I don't think that it means that I can necessarily excuse or judge how those same experiences might affect someone else.
So, Pamela, what do we do with the fact that, you know, if you brushed off something that now is considered inappropriate, if I did the same, there are lots of people who would judge us as having sort of perpetuated the problem by making it possible for this to happen to someone else down the line.
Right. I mean, again, it's really interesting, right? Because it's a situation, I think, where people are looking for figures to blame, right? And so there's a situation where, you know, we are saying, okay, largely men are responsible for this poor behavior. And yet people then might turn against women and say, you're responsible because you allowed for this behavior to go on. And again, I don't know that that's all necessarily fair, because people are idiosyncratic. We are all different. And if it didn't bother us, and then, you know, there's also the factor that plays a part, which is that someone might say to themselves, look, I really don't like the way this boss is behaving, but I need this job, and I don't have the time or the financial ability to just quit and look for something else. So I am going to suck it up, and I am going to stay with this job, even though this boss is behaving disrespectfully and making me uncomfortable, because the money is important to me, and this job works for me because it's an easy commute or whatever reasons. I don't think it's fair then to blame that woman necessarily for perpetuating a system.
So many of these incidents, not the most egregious, you know, situations of sexual harassment and assault, but the ones that sort of fall a couple of degrees below that. It, you know, part of me thinks, like, if only the perpetrator could have just thought twice before opening their mouth or, you know, doing something, we could prevent these things. Maybe there's some value to making an example of people like Frank Langella.
I don't know. I don't like to think of individuals' lives as being deeply affected in order to serve as an example. I just don't think that that's necessarily fair to the very human individuals involved here to say, look, you know, maybe you didn't do something terrible. Maybe it wasn't so bad, but we need to hold you up as an example and sort of take a hit for all of those people who did do things that were terrible.
There's also the risk of making the perpetrators, or whatever you want to call the people who have behaved inappropriately, feel like the victims in these situations. That seems to happen quite a lot.
Yes. And I think they, you know, Harvey Weinstein is a prime example. He did feel like he was a victim. And, you know, that's the way he felt. I don't think that anyone, you know, most people will really accept that. But again, for those who are innocent, they are victims. I think that, you know, these situations, and, you know, again, and I'm talking now about you mentioned that the much less egregious examples, you do need to think about, I do think we need to think about, what if someone is innocent? What if someone didn't do it? Again, going back to believe all women, which again, I think is something we shouldn't believe, because we shouldn't believe anyone necessarily. People say all kinds of things that are untrue. We need to think about what happens when we should be believing the man, and what do you do? What's the recourse in those situations for someone who is unjustly accused?
This piece, Pamela, also engages with the idea that there are different standards of behavior for different generations, particularly at this moment. Younger adults, I think, have a lot less tolerance for things. I'm a Gen Xer, raised by baby boomers. I think previous generations were sort of taught to not fight these things in quite the same ways. How do we decide which generation's views on this to prioritize when you bring together people of lots of different eras?
Right. Well, if you're a Gen Xer, I am too. And so you've probably heard the phrase, you know, suck it up. That's kind of what we were told. And I was actually raised not by baby boomers, but by the silent generation, the children of the Depression and war era. And I think for them, especially because they grew up at a time where, you know, you didn't take a job for granted, and standards, you know, people were glad to just be able to get by. And they raised Gen X, which is also a kind of small beleaguered generation that graduated into largely into periods of recession. So I think that the mentality among these older generations is, you know, deal with it, roll with it. And that is not something that millennials or Zoomers, I guess is now what they're called, Generation Z, that's not something that they are going to put up with. And I think that given the fact that that's the rising generation in the workplace, people in their 20s and 30s, companies are making a calculation that they need to really work by those standards. What's tough now is that you still have people of a previous generation who are working there. And obviously, most large organizations in particular are doing a lot of workplace training around issues of diversity, around issues of gender and sex, and making sure that people are trained in those older generations if they weren't familiar with the rules were, so that they know that the standards have changed. I think the hardest part, and one of the things that happened during Me Too, is that was like before everyone had gotten the memo, really. I mean, of course there was workplace training, and it's not like people were unaware of sexual harassment, but it wasn't quite as widespread. And I think people, you know, there was a sort of a little bit more tolerance, and some of the people who got sort of taken down, as it were, during the Me Too era, again, of lesser, you know, crimes, quote unquote, than people like Harvey Weinstein, but just of having sort of not done things that are up to today's standards, they felt like really unfairly trapped. They kind of were felled by standards that they hadn't come into their jobs expecting to uphold.
I don't think the New York Times allows people to comment on op-eds. Am I right about that?
They do. So on columns and op-eds, people can comment. Are you asking because this one wasn't open to comments?
I'm just curious about what you've heard from people who read the piece.
So I actually, interestingly, heard from a lot of people who had been accused, feeling grateful. I also heard from women who are married, or maybe the mothers. I don't know what necessarily the relationship is, who said that they were grateful that I wrote a little bit more about these gray areas and these areas of nuance. And this is one of the reasons why I tried to make clear in the piece that this is not an anti-women. This is not a kind of war of the sexes. Both men and women are affected by these issues. And so that was interesting to me, and not totally surprising. Again, because part of the reason I wrote this piece is I know people who have been accused. I know about their spouses or their girlfriends or their partners, and I know what the fallout has been like for them.
Do you have any sense of why so often, not exclusively, but so often, it is women accusing men of this kind of bad behavior? It seems like it should work both ways, but it really doesn't seem to.
Well, you know, there are some differences between the sexes, and sexism, male sexism against women is long ingrained in our culture, as it is in many other cultures, and men often are, you know, far more often the aggressors. If you look at rape statistics, if you look at domestic violence, it is far more often that men are the perpetrators in these situations. And so in the workplace, I think you're going to see that same kind of proportions.
Should there be some moratorium on the I didn't know this would hurt your feelings, or I didn't know this would upset you, or I didn't know this was inappropriate defense?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that you know, people make mistakes all the time. I think we're living in a period of time where I think we're very focused on retribution as a society in America overall. I think we're really interested in punishment in this country. But I also think that, and we're interested in apologies, but I don't know that we are necessarily as attuned to the notion of mercy and forgiveness. And people say stupid things all the time. I mean, look, I go to sleep almost every night before going to bed. I have a moment of like, I shouldn't have said this. What if I said that differently? And they're not necessarily, you know, offensive things. They're just things I wish I had done differently during the day. It's like we all kind of review our day and think like, if I could do it all over, I wouldn't have said this to my son, and maybe I would have done this at dinner. And so, I think that people are never going to stop making mistakes. And sometimes people do things intentionally, and sometimes they really just mess up.
All right, let's go back to the phones. We have Paul on the line in Dallas. Hello, Paul.
Hello.
Hi, Paul.
Go
right. Yeah, we're hearing from...
I can't hear because of somebody in the background.
Okay. I think, Paul, just tell me if I'm right about this. You wanted to talk about the parallels between racial discrimination and the idea that people were forgiven for racist acts if they said they didn't mean any
it's
harm.
It's hard to hear you at all because of whoever the person, somebody's talking in the background.
Okay, I think we must be having problems with the line there. I apologize for that. But if I understand based on our screening, Pamela, this idea, there are some parallels, right, between, you know, white people in particular who for years said, well, I didn't mean any harm, or, you know, I don't know why you were hurt by this racist thing that you've perceived to be racist that I don't think is so. How strong do you think those parallels are to something like the Me Too movement?
I think they're definitely very strong, particularly when it comes to words as opposed to actions, because it's more common, although, of course, racial violence occurs, as we know well, particularly thinking about incident in Buffalo. But in most workplaces, it is less a case of, assault and physical violence as it is a case of words. And I think that the parallels are absolutely there. And not only that, but in terms of the time frame, because I think that with the murder of George Floyd in 2020 and the kind of racial reckoning that has fallen out from that, there's a real overlap. Me Too, the sort of, years in which that happened, really the year before, and a little bit the year prior to that. And so you have these two enormous sort of reckonings and increased levels of awareness in a very close period of time. And so, again, you have people who just aren't quite fully caught up on the fact that, you know what? It is no longer okay to do these things. It's not okay to say these things. It's not okay to treat other people in this way. And you have this period right now where, look, we're only 2 years out from the murder of George Floyd. It's not like change happens overnight for every single person. It takes a period of adjustment. And we're in that really tough period right now where people are still trying to understand and then enact standards that are different from the ones they may have grown up with.
It's interesting when you have a case that involves an infraction that is not a criminal offense. If someone is accused of criminal misconduct, there's a very standard process, and we could, argue whether that's always necessarily going to lead to real justice, but at least both sides get to have their say and someone gets to present a defense. That's not necessarily the case. And even sometimes people are cleared by a company and people don't absolutely trust that that's fair, that they didn't really do something wrong.
Yeah, I think that, again, there are a few different situations here. There's a situation where someone does something criminal and terrible and there are repercussions. There are situations where someone does something far less, certainly not criminal and far less severe, and then they are there is a serious negative outcome for them. They're fired or whatever it might be. And then there are cases where, you know, people might be innocent and they're fired or there are repercussions. And I do think, again, if we're going to try to think about what to do with one or two of these situations, we need to also think about the third. And what troubles me is that, again, you know, workplace situations, it's not like a court of law. It's really hard to prove that an accusation is false. It's really hard to come back from that. And especially when that accusation becomes public or one-sidedly public. In the situation with Frank Langella, for example, we have his name. We don't know the name of the actress. And so you really don't have all the facts. And let's say, and again, I don't know, but let's say Frank Langella is innocent or didn't intend to, you know, he's in one of those gray areas. There really isn't a coming back for him, or it's really difficult. There's no roadmap for that. There have been instances, a few, very rare, where someone has come back from being accused. The accusation was investigated and people said this does not have merit. And the person kind of went on with their lives. But I don't think without some kind of damage being done. And I do think that when we think about punishing and consequences for the guilty, we do have to equally think about what do we do when we're wrong? What do we do if they're not guilty? And how do we protect against that?
The other thing that we do in our culture, Pamela, is decide that certain kinds of bad behavior are an indication of someone's overall character as opposed to an indication of a really bad choice they made in the moment. You understand what I'm saying? Like, we sort of
Absolutely.
Brand people for life as espousing these ideas. And I think some people maybe, you know, they behave in these sexist ways because they do espouse sexist ideas, but it may not always be the case. But, you know.
Well, yeah. You know, I think about this as a parent. And as a parent, we're always very conscious with our children, not to compare all, you know, adults to children, but we're always very conscious as parents with children to differentiate between bad behavior and bad people and to teach our children that difference, to say, look, you know, your friend lied in this instant, but that doesn't make him a liar, or your friend behaved poorly, but that doesn't mean he's a bad person. And we say that to our children ourselves, look, something you did here was wrong, but I don't think you're a bad person. I know you're a good person. Your behavior wasn't good in this instant, but you are good. And I think that is important, not just to think about that in terms of parenting young children, but it's a lesson we teach them because it's important for all of us to bear in mind as adults, as human beings.
Do you think it's still important for people to speak up immediately and loudly when they feel like they have been abused or mistreated or harassed?
I think that it is important if someone feels like they have been mistreated for them to have a recourse to action. When you say loudly, I think that we need to be a little clear about what we mean. I think that they certainly should be able to go to a party, an organization, let's say human resources, to a manager. They should be able to speak directly to that person themselves if that's appropriate and feels comfortable. Should they necessarily go on Twitter and make an accusation to someone who's a private citizen? Not necessarily. But I do think that people do have the right to speak out against injustices or poor behavior and to hope that there is, you know, that those accusations are taken seriously.
Do you think Me Too has permanently changed workplace culture?
I think it has. And I think, you know, again, largely to the good. As I hope I've made clear in this conversation, I do think, you know, it's complicated always. And nothing is ever 100% good, or very rare to find something that is an unalloyed good. There are always unanticipated consequences. And we need to just begin to think about those.
Pamela, thanks so much for making time to talk about this.
Thank you for having me.
Pamela Paul is an opinion columnist for The New York Times. Her recent op-ed was titled, Netflix Fired Frank Langella. Was That the Right Thing to Do? You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. If you want the podcast, you can get it free wherever you get podcasts. Just search for KERA Think and subscribe, or catch up on what you've missed at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.